It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. The government shutdown that started on October 1st is still ongoing. It's now the longest shutdown in U.S. history.
Democrats in the Senate have been calling for a deal that would extend Affordable Care Act subsidies past the end of the year. Republicans are blaming Democrats for the shutdown dragging on. And meanwhile, 1 million federal workers are either furloughed or working without pay.
We're inviting members of Wisconsin's congressional delegation to weigh in. Tomorrow, we'll hear from U.S. Senator Ron Johnson at this time. Now, Democratic Representative Mark Pocan joins us, representing Wisconsin's 2nd Congressional District. That includes Madison, Reedsburg, and Dodgeville. Representative Pocan, welcome back to the show.
Well, thanks for having me, Rob. Appreciate it.
Your Democratic colleagues in the Senate have been saying throughout that health care subsidies for the Affordable Care Act marketplace and some other health care coverage-related funding are what's keeping them from extending government funding now. For you, what is the minimum commitment on health care that you'd want to see that would make you say, yeah, go ahead, let's do this?
Well, first, I mean, I think you have to take it to a 30,000-foot level. You have to show up in Washington to do anything. And we are now on our 7th week of essentially paid vacation because Mike Johnson hasn't had the House in session. So from, you know, the top 30,000-foot level, we have to get back to work. We have a farm bill that's 2 years overdue. We have an Older Americans Act, I think, that's a year overdue. We have a bunch of bills to do, and holding your breath isn't the answer. Having said that, this fight is clearly about health care, because in the big ugly law that was passed a few months back, they took away health care from 15 million people, raised all of our rates in the process, and they did it without a plan. For 15 years, they have, since the Affordable Care Act was passed, not had a plan. The closest we've got has been a concept of a plan that Donald Trump told us about in a debate, but there is nothing even to that concept. So, yes, you can't take away health care without having some alternative plan, and the fight is largely about that.
The subsidy issue, though, these are subsidies that were added during COVID, saying, okay, yes, we've got this health emergency. We need a little extra something here. That emergency is done. Isn't it time, maybe, as Republicans are arguing, for those subsidies to end and go back to what the plan was pre-COVID?
What they are actually doing was, you know, like any law, if you see when we put that in place in 2010, many people got coverage, but we saw there were some people that didn't have coverage. So when we did that, along with other health-related things, this was just simply what we do every day, is tweaking laws to make them serve their actual purpose. And in this case, it was making sure that more people had affordable health care, those who needed it. And based on the holes that we saw in the plan, that was put in place. Also, we always do sunsets, so you can continue to review it, and that's simply where we're at. So it's nothing related specifically to COVID or anything else. This is just what we do. You tweak laws as you see there's holes or things didn't work out as you intended. And, you know, to take that away from people now without an alternative is somewhere between stupid and cruel.
People are shopping for coverage on the marketplace and elsewhere right now. Average rates expected to go up. I've seen averages of $1,000+ for a year, but some people, especially at the higher limits of the coverage, could see $1,000 or $2,000 a month. What are you hearing from constituents as the marketplace open enrollment is open?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, averages are a tough number to use. I think it's like 23% or something like that average increase, but it really depends on your age and your plan. And if you're in that 57 to 65 range, you could get hit with up to a $2,000 a month increase because of the changes they did. And obviously, that's why they're saying 4 million people will lose their health care just from this. But also, because of the uncompensated care that this and the Medicaid changes are going to create, we're all paying more right now. So group plans are also coming out for next year. And I had one Madison employer told me their increase was 41%. So while not directly in the big ugly law, it's very much related to the people losing health care. It's not like you don't get sick. Someone has to pay for that at the end of the day. Insurance companies are factoring that in. And now we're all paying more for health care.
Representative Derek Van Orden, Republican from Western Wisconsin, talked to the media this week in La Crosse. Here's somewhat he had to say about the shutdown.
Me and my Republican colleagues in the House of Representatives and every Republican senator except for one voted collectively 14 times to keep the government open and to fund WIC, SNAP, Border Patrol, military, the FAA, our air traffic controllers. We voted, the Republicans voted 14 times to keep the government open. The Democrats have voted 14 times to shut the government down and keep it shut down.
That audio from the La Crosse Tribune, Representative Van Orden went on to say there's nothing to talk to them about, referring to House Democrats saying we passed a bill. That's how government works. He gave that litany of things that are affected by the shutdown. Is the potential harm created by problems with SNAP funding, air traffic control and so on worth it for this fight for health care subsidies?
Well, the American people get it. We're not in charge of the government. The Republicans are. And if they put together a partisan CR that locks in the health care cuts and the education cuts and the food assistance cuts, by the way, they voted to cut $158 billion to the SNAP program. Derek Van Orden and other Republicans in Wisconsin did. If you put all that in place by just doing a continuing resolution, we're actually accomplishing all their goals. Also, Donald Trump is doing rescissions of funds, which is a fancy Washington word for saying he's stealing the funds that Congress has approved in a bipartisan way, which means you never have an agreement. So, you know, I don't know if Derek is either trying to lie or he just doesn't understand it or a mixture of the both, but clearly the American people do get it when you look at the polling. If the Republicans are in charge of the House and the Senate and the White House, and they're not talking to us and they're not showing up to work, I think most people get why we're in this situation. First thing we should do is start going back to Washington. We have a farm bill that's 2 years overdue. We have an Older Americans Act reauthorization overdue. We have a whole lot of work to do. And simply holding your breath and spending most of the time in your basement tweeting, drinking a pitcher of pina coladas, like I think Derek and other Republicans are doing, is anything but acceptable.
Talking to we're talking to Democratic Representative Mark Pocan of Wisconsin, looking at the ongoing government shutdown. Another Republican colleague, Glenn Grothman, talked to WPR yesterday, talking about the SNAP benefits and the impact on the shutdown vote.
It's completely unnecessary. I had hoped that the delay in food stamps in the last week would kind of shake things up a little bit and cause people to at least allow the government to stay open. That didn't happen.
Representative Pocan, those benefits not going out. Some question, the president has said, hey, maybe half benefits covered by emergency funds. Does that change the calculus? This would have a direct impact on many of your constituents.
Well, first of all, I mean, we had put a contingency fund together of somewhere between $5 and $6 billion, which covers about 3/4 of a month's worth of benefits. And even the Department of Agriculture under Donald Trump admitted that was congressional intent to use that. So the fact that they even fought it in the first place didn't make any sense because he accessed that fund in his first administration when there was a shutdown. Having said that, I think the more incredulous part is Republicans in the Big Ugly Law cut the SNAP program, the very program they now claim to be defenders of, by $158 billion. Millions of people won't get access to food assistance. It's the number one program keeping kids out of poverty. So you can't have it one way when you cut funding for the program. So in the future, millions of people won't have access. And then now say someone else's fault because it's not happening, even though we put a contingency fund together in a bipartisan way to deal with this. I just think the rhetoric is so far off the charts. People need to get back to Washington and work. And short of that, they're AWOL, they're derelict of duty. And I just don't see how they think not showing up and getting a paycheck is accountability.
To get out of this shutdown, what kind of deal do you need to see? Do you need in this funding bill those subsidies extended, or is there some kind of solid commitment to, hey, here's a plan, we're going to vote on it separately by X date? Would that do the job for you?
Yeah, I think in general, we have to figure out how to get some actual language or a vote, or quite honestly, some protection for the funds that we'd be passing so the president doesn't just continue stealing them, which he doesn't have the legal authority to do. And there are lawsuits on that, but you would need some language to ensure some of that. Otherwise, every deal we have is never a deal if the president goes in and steals the funds that we just agreed to. And that is what's happening right now. So, you know, this is a crisis largely created by Donald Trump. He's telling Congress what to do. They jump when he says jump. And right now, he needs to tell them to get back to work, because we actually have things we need to do.
Switching gears for a moment, we had an election on Tuesday, not here in Wisconsin, but it's one of those odd numbered year tea leaf sort of events. Democrats did well in states around the country. What's your reaction to the outcomes we saw on Tuesday?
Well, I mean, I think a lot of what we've been saying we thought would happen did happen, and we are glad to see. People are tired of paying too much for things. Donald Trump got elected largely on the economy. 50% of people in exit polls said they were paying too much for goods because inflation was high coming out of COVID, and he said he had addressed that. Instead, we're paying more for groceries and durable goods because of Trump's tariff taxes. We're paying more for energy and now healthcare because of the big ugly law, and housing has remained high. So I think people get, if their pocketbook, if their wallet is not able to cover their expenses like they were promised, this is not what they signed up for. And I think between that and just the real imminent face of people losing healthcare and what that can do to a family or a neighbor of you know, anyone that's close to people, all of that, I think, came into play on Tuesday. And that's why we saw the big wins in very diverse parts of the country.
Very briefly, assuming the shutdown ends sometime soon, what, you've mentioned the farm bill, what else do you think should be Congress's top priority once you're back to business?
Well, I think as soon as we get back in, they put in place Adelita Grijalva from Arizona. That means we'll probably have a vote on the Epstein files. I think we should vote on members of Congress not being able to trade stock. Everyone says they're for it, but it doesn't mean anything if you don't have a vote. Absolutely, the farm bill.
I think we've lost Representative Pocan, happily right at the end of the interview anyway. Thanks to U.S. Representative Mark Pocan, Democrat representing Wisconsin's 2nd Congressional District. Been talking about the ongoing government shutdown, now officially the longest in U.S. history, and what negotiations are looking like on Capitol Hill. Tomorrow at this time, Republican Senator Ron Johnson joins the show.
Up, the Community Reinvestment Act was created almost 50 years ago by a senator from Wisconsin. The author of a new book tells us how it works.
This provides an accountability mechanism and has increased lending in traditionally underserved and formerly redlined communities.
That's ahead on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. In 1977, the late Wisconsin Senator William Proxmire was the driving force in the creation of the Community Reinvestment Act. This law aimed to end redlining and discriminatory lending practices, and it still requires banks to invest in the communities they serve.
Better known as the CRA, it is still being debated and revised today. Advocates for the law argue it benefits cities across the country, like Milwaukee, but that it needs updates for the internet banking age.
Josh Silver worked for the National Community Reinvestment Coalition for more than 30 years. His new book is called Ending Redlining Through a Community-Centered Reform of the Community Reinvestment Act. Josh, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you.
We're going to dig into it in a lot more detail, but can you give us a quick sense of the intent of the Community Reinvestment Act? What is it supposed to do, and what's its mechanism to do it?
Well, for decades, communities of color and working class communities were discriminated against, and this is the area of lending. So banks would discriminate against these neighborhoods, and they would not make loans in these neighborhoods. And I will describe redlining in more detail, but literally red lines were drawn around neighborhoods. And if you can't get home loans or small business loans, your neighborhoods will not thrive. They will become economically distressed. So actually, actually in Wisconsin, your great late Senator William Proxmire saw that this was devastating neighborhoods. And he worked with advocates across the country to pass the Community Reinvestment Act in 1977, which requires banks to serve all communities, including low and moderate income communities, consistent with safety and soundness. You know, I'm quoting the statute. And the way this is implemented is federal bank agencies, there's three of them, conduct exams and literally grade banks. And anybody from the general public can go to the internet and look at a bank exam and see how banks are lending in Wisconsin to communities of color, low and moderate income communities. And this provides an accountability mechanism and has increased lending in traditionally underserved and formerly redlined communities.
I want to dig more into the Wisconsin origins. You mentioned Senator, the late Senator William Proxmire, and he was working with community leaders, community groups, and inspired, I think, partly by what was going on in Milwaukee when it came to lending and housing. Could you talk a little more about the path from there, seeing this problem, to passing this law?
Sure. So there were advocates across the country, including in Wisconsin, but also in other parts of the Midwest. The mother of CRA, she's called the mother of CRA, is a woman named Gail Sincotta. And she had an advocacy organization that witnessed neighborhoods being blockbusted. Real estate agents would come in and say, you know, the African-Americans are coming. You need to sell your house now. So these unscrupulous real estate agents would scoop up the houses at bargain prices and sell them at a markup to African-Americans. And the lending was also predatory. So Gail Sincotta and it was called National People's Action, thought if you could just get banks to reinvest and end redlining and get banks to make conventional responsible loans, this would stabilize neighborhoods. It would integrate neighborhoods. She was working class white ethnic. Let's integrate neighborhoods and have working class whites living next to African Americans. So she worked with Senator William Proxmire to develop CRA and to get it through Congress. And it required the legislative genius of William Proxmire because it got through Congress by the thinnest of margins.
When people hear, people of color, black people in particular, face discrimination in the housing market, they may have a vague sense of what that means. At a practical level, we had decades, right, where the federal government said, hey, you effectively can't get a loan for a building that's in what's a primarily black neighborhood. And if you wanted to move out of that neighborhood and you were black, in many cases, you couldn't. What did that discrimination mean on a practical level for a black person who wanted to own a house and build that equity over the years that many white people were able to enjoy and benefit from?
If people want to see what the redlining maps look like, you can go to the University of Richmond website, type in your Google search, University of Richmond redlining maps. And these maps were developed by the federal government, believe it or not, in the 1930s. And there was an incredible amount of racist assumptions here that neighborhoods that were predominantly African American or recent Eastern European immigrants and Jews, they would classify these neighborhoods as highly risky. So over the decades, banks avoided these neighborhoods. You combined redlining and lending discrimination with other forms of discrimination and segregation. There are racial covenants in houses saying that if you are a white homeowner in a white neighborhood, you could not sell to an African American or a Jew. And then you fast forward, there are other practices in the real estate industry where realtors would steer black borrowers to black neighborhoods, white borrowers to white neighborhoods. And then you fast forward even later, the subprime lending crisis, predatory lenders. There was still a dearth of bank lending in a lot of African-American neighborhoods. Predatory lenders took up the slack. And, you know, the subprime lending crisis that resulted in the Great Recession around 2008. So you have decades of this. And people of color had fewer choices, a lot fewer choices in neighborhoods where they could live. And this was a great contributor to the wealth disparity, the disparities of home ownership across the country, and also health disparities, dramatic differences in life expectancy due to discrimination across a lot of areas of life.
Now, since the book came out, you wrote a piece in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel with an example, a real-world example of how the Community Reinvestment Act works. You look at the Metro Milwaukee Fair Housing Council and UMB Financial Corporation. What was their agreement? How does it relate to this the CRA?
Thank you for mentioning the opinion piece. The opinion piece actually shows an example of a redlining map in action that victimized a Haymarket neighborhood in Milwaukee, where you see dramatic differences in life chances and poverty levels, Haymarket neighborhood compared to the neighborhoods that were not redlined. So what CRA does, because there is a public rating, and when banks merge, the federal agencies are required to consider the CRA record. This encouraged banks to reach out to communities. Banks are required in merger applications to demonstrate a public benefit. How is this merger going to benefit the public? So what some banks do is, we're going to make an agreement, and we call them community benefits agreements, with community organizations. And the Metro Milwaukee Fair Housing Council was one of several organizations that struck an agreement with the UMB. After their merger, UMB pledged to make $5 billion in loans and investments over a five-year time period. A lot of it was actually small business and community development related, a little less on the home lending front. But this is a win-win. It is more loans after the merger than before. Banks find profitable lending opportunities, as the research has demonstrated over several years, and neighborhoods get a chance to revitalize and build wealth.
And you mentioned the subprime mortgage crisis that helped kick off the Great Recession. And you talk about in the book, some critics of the Community Reinvestment Act say, aha, the federal government is forcing banks into these communities to make unsafe, unsound loans. You disagree with that. A lot of the loans in question were not under, as I understand it, under the Community Reinvestment Act. Sort that out.
You know, you will have conservative critics saying, CRA is forcing banks to make unsafe and unsound loans. They haven't read the statute. The CRA statute requires banks to make loans consistent with safety and soundness. And what the problem was leading up to the Great Recession is CRA covers banks. CRA does not cover independent mortgage companies that are not required by federal law to make loans consistent with safety and soundness. So independent mortgage companies were making the risky loans with loan terms and conditions that the borrowers could not afford, and selling the loans on Wall Street. And Wall Street, the investment banks are not covered by CRA. So the problem was uneven coverage and a lack of CRA or a law like CRA for independent mortgage companies and Wall Street firms. And there is research done by Federal Reserve economists and other academics that, in my mind, conclusively demonstrate that it wasn't CRA loans by banks. Those loans were responsible, were not ending up in foreclosure. It was the loans made by independent mortgage companies that led to the foreclosure crisis.
We're talking about the Community Reinvestment Act, established in 1977. It was made in response to lending discrimination. Josh Silver is with us. His new book is called Ending Redlining Through a Community-Centered Reform of the Community Reinvestment Act. Let's get to the reform part of that subtitle there. You think the CRA has been a good thing, not perfect, but a benefit. But you see the need for change, especially as banking has evolved over the years. What kind of changes do you see a need for?
Sure. Well, first of all, I think CRA should be broadly applied throughout the financial industry. You were just talking about independent mortgage companies. They should have CRA. And some states like Massachusetts actually do cover independent mortgage companies with CRA-like law. So the CRA that we live with now was basically made in 1995. The regulation in 1995 describes how CRA exams will assess banks' lending and investment performance. So we're now in 2025. And there was a need to make some of the performance measures more objective, like percent of loans to low and moderate income borrowers. How do you know what's outstanding, that's the highest grade? And what do you know? How do you know what is failing? You have to do a better job comparing banks to each other and the demographics in the community. So in 2023, under the Biden administration, the agencies undertook a multi-year effort to make the performance measures more objective and also to update the community reinvestment exams. In 1995, the internet barely existed. And now there is a good amount of lending done through the internet. Bank branches are still very important, but there'll be more and more lending done through the internet and outside of branch networks. And the 2023 regulatory update to CRA took that into account and examined banks in geographic areas where they were making lots of loans but did not have branches. Well, fast forward, elections have consequences, and the Trump administration has announced its intention to repeal the Biden CRA regulation. So we're going to go back to 1995. And what I know for sure is banks themselves go crazy about, oh, is this loan going to count on my CRA exam because it's made outside of my branch network? Well, I want the banks to work with community advocates to, at a future time, to update CRA and to get rid of a lot of these inefficiencies that drive a lot of us crazy.
The way I think of the community reinvestment maybe matches up with an older model of bank ownership where the bank is in that city and maybe they only make loans in this part of the city but not these other parts, and that's what the CRA is trying to fix. How would you want to see this dealt with if I'm an internet bank? Where's Milwaukee? I can't even find it on a map. How is that organization supposed to work with a local community group when it has really no footprint in that community except for some internet lending?
Most banks are a hybrid. They'll have some branches. They'll do some lending through the internet. But even a lot of mortgage companies today are becoming more and more internet-based. But they still establish relationships in the community. They have a relationship with brokers. If you ever worked with a mortgage broker, they'll refer you to a mortgage company you never heard of, and you will never go into their office. So, even today, your internet-based lenders establish relationships with stakeholders in the community, whether it's mortgage brokers, for example. So they should be able to find mortgage brokers that are oriented to serving neighborhoods like Haymarket that were previously redlined, and also work with the Metropolitan Milwaukee Fair Housing Council. Even though you're an internet-based lender, you can still offer a grant to the Metro Milwaukee Fair Housing Center. Maybe you have staff that are not too far away that can come and do a joint counseling session or, do a virtual one. So I think there are ways, and there are ways today that an internet-based lender can make sure that, say, operations in Wisconsin or Milwaukee can serve traditionally underserved populations by partnering with stakeholders that do this.
This is a federal law. We're talking about, do states, can states go above and beyond the Community Reinvestment Act?
Sure. As I mentioned, Massachusetts earlier, Connecticut, New York. Massachusetts has applied CRA to mortgage companies and credit unions. And so Illinois is more recent, but just has done that as well. There's a bill in New York State considering a CRA-like obligation for insurance companies. There was an issue of redlining for homeowners insurance as well. Show us the data. Do an exam. How many of your policyholders are low and moderate income or live in low and moderate income neighborhoods? California is considering a bill. So this is going on the state level, and hopefully these bills will percolate back up to the federal level. Matter of fact, that's what happened when women got the right to vote around 1920. There was state laws passed allowing women to vote, and it just reached a crescendo where the feds felt that they had to act. And I hope eventually that's what happens with CRA.
looking to the future. You write that you don't think that the Community Reinvestment Act could be repealed. You don't see the votes in Congress there. Do you have concerns, though, with the Trump administration in particular, which has not been friendly to programs that seem to want to address past racial inequities, that a presidential administration could water it down heavily?
Well, we're seeing that already with the regulation. A law is implemented through the regulation, and the CRA regulation describes how CRA exams are to occur. So it is happening already. But there are cycles in our country, and I think in future years, regardless whether it's Republican or Democrat, I hope a future administration is more friendly to CRA. We are creating a very impressive constituency for CRA. There are thousands of banks in this country. There are thousands of nonprofit organizations in this country. And every day, they are working in partnership to do home lending, small business lending, community development, like healthcare centers and childcare centers. And they are documenting their CRA success stories. And in the past, when there has been congressional hearings, you'll see banks testifying that CRA is an important, valuable law that has helped them serve previously overlooked communities and has led them to profitable lending and banking opportunities. So I think that this institution building, this constituent building, we need to keep at it. We need to keep making it stronger. There will be times when CRA is strengthened, times when it is weakened. But overall, I don't think there are the votes in Congress to repeal it, because it makes capitalism work better in all communities. People who are willing to work hard and play by the rules, they should get a home loan or a small business loan, regardless of the color of the skin. And there's a lot of people in the banking industry that understand why this is important for their bottom lines. So I think it's CRA is going to survive. And a lot of us hope it's strengthened and it thrives and it really helps economic prosperity in the long term.
Josh, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Well, thank you. I appreciate talking to you.
Josh Silver is the author of Ending Redlining Through a Community-Centered Reform of the Community Reinvestment Act. The book examines the law that intended to eradicate redlining. It was introduced by the late Wisconsin Senator William Proxmire in 1977.
Coming up, the creators of a new disability justice zine talk about the inspiration behind the project and what goes into making books accessible for people with visual disabilities.
So it's a lot more than a coloring book. There's open-ended prompts asking people to think about what hurts and what care they need.
Go inside the new zine called Crip Wisdoms. That's next from WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Zines are growing in popularity as people seek out alternatives to digital spaces and their devices. Zines are tangible media we can hold in our hands.
For two UW-Madison graduate students, creating a zine together opened up possibilities to think about self-care through the framework of disability justice.
And with the help of a special publisher, they created a tactile version of the zine for blind readers that includes Braille and other textures to tell the story through touch.
Emily Knott is an artist, educator, and doctoral candidate in curriculum and instruction, and Miso Kwok is a doctoral candidate in special education. Their new zine is called Crip Wisdoms, a feminist disability studies coloring book, and they joined us recently in studio to talk about navigating the world with disabilities and their collaboration. Em begins by explaining how this project came into focus.
Well, the project started in a UW-Madison course. It was Dr. Sammy Schalk's Feminist Disability Studies course. And when we read the book, Kemi Nishida's book, Just Care, I immediately, as an artist scholar, saw images in my mind of what that page represented. So instead of bringing in my assigned one-pager for the class discussion, I brought in a coloring page. And thankfully, Dr. Schalk didn't say, "You get an F," because you were supposed to bring in a one-pager. She said, "This is beautiful. You should keep doing it. You should make this thing a thing. You should finish it. You should make this book. And I almost immediately called Miso, a friend, co-conspirator, collaborator, and was like, do you want to do this thing with me? And thank goodness she said yes.
Miso, what piqued your interest about this project?
Oh, I think, first of all, just working with Emily always is a joy. So I was really excited that Em reached out to me. And yeah, it was just a lot of things kind of aligning really well. And I'm really grateful to have been part of this project and working together for this very meaningful and wonderful experience.
There's this long history behind the term Crip, which can be viewed as an offensive term. It can also be empowering within some disability circles. And you decide to use it in the title of the book. What does that word mean to you?
Absolutely. So we join many disability justice activists and scholars in reclaiming the term Crip, which has long been used to talk down to disability communities and instead reclaim it as a term of power and identity. And we also use a plural wisdoms to acknowledge that there's many ways of knowing and being in disability experience. And so that's how we came to the title of Crip Wisdoms.
Yeah, as somebody who studies disability identity and someone just personally outside of my academic studies who has grappled and continues to grapple with my own identity as a disabled person and disabled scholar and what that means, I think reclaiming a Crip is a way for me to not only signify my pride and my solidarity with the community, but also invitation to others to rethink what this term means and yeah, just kind of uplifting this term that has been historicized in a negative way into something that is powerful and that carries nuanced meanings.
Let's stay on the front cover here. There's also this row of illustrated spoons with different shapes and different designs. Can you talk about the spoon theory and how this concept helped you in your own life and why it's on the cover?
Sure. And I'll shout out Christine Miserandino, whose 2013 blog post was the first place where spoon theory was coined. But spoons, this quote is from Leah Lakshmi Pyepsna Samarasinha. She says, spoons is slang created by sick and disabled communities to describe units of energy and capacity, specifically within a sick and disabled context of having a limited amount of energy because of chronic illness or disability. And so when I put it on the cover, it was really thinking about ways in, because I felt like the ideas I encountered in feminist disability studies have helped me make sense of my own life and experiences. Particularly, I've had chronic migraines since I was 7 years old. And so having ideas at my fingertips like spoons and like bed activism were ways to not fold those experiences in on myself and hide them and feel shame about them, but instead enfold them into my identity and think about what they looked like and how I lived them every day. And so putting spoons on the cover was a way to say, everyone knows what a spoon is. You can hold it in your hand. It's something approachable. It's something you can look at and think about. And instead of having these ideas live kind of siloed, maybe in academic spaces, really making sure that a zine that's something anyone can look at and understand and read through and color and engage with, it was a way to give people almost an on-ramp into these ideas that for me and for so many other people have been really life-giving and life-affirming and have been an important part of our experiences and ourselves.
I wonder, Miso, when you are finding yourself out of spoons in any given day, do you have any tips or ways that you self-care? Or what happens when you're out of spoons?
Yeah, I think I'm actually a terrible person to give that answer because I am, you know, a very type A person who's, you know, pursuing a PhD, and that basically means that I've kind of conformed to this fast-paced, productive ideals, right? And so I think as I've kind of immersed myself in disability studies and just coming to know myself, I think I've been really trying to be better about that, what it means to care about myself and other, So one, I think, is to know, like, when to take a break and actually take the break and carving out time for things like going outside for a walk or intentionally cooking something. So I think it is really challenging, but I'm constantly trying to do better and also encouraging my friends to take a day off when they need to take an afternoon off. Because most of the times I'm like really reiterating it to myself that a little bit of postponement doesn't really end up being the end of the world. And I think I just need to constantly remind myself and also others so that I can kind of start this culture of slowing down.
In the grand scheme of things,
yes,
it will all be the same in the end in some respects. You know, these spoons aren't just decorative. They're also dotted lines around them. You can cut them out. Your readers can cut them out. Why was it important to make them this way and not just, you know, a text-based book, but an interactive zine?
So we really wanted this to be more than a coloring book. We, on each page, include not only the sources and citations and invitations to read more of the people that we're thinking with and quoting and citing, but also different ways in. So for the spoons page, you can cut out a spoon and write on it something you need and hand it to someone. Oh. Or you could write something that you have to offer and hand it to someone. There's pages near the end of the book where we actually ask people to draw and envision their own radical possibilities for disability justice and what they see in the future. So it's a lot more than a coloring book.
I think I saw somewhere that, you know, there's never a dead end in this book, that there's always more possibilities for you to engage or to think or to reflect or color or what have you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
One of my favorite parts of this book has been seeing it under other people's hands and hearts and eyes and minds and bodies and seeing how it transforms and how it gets used, you know, getting messages from around the country of pages that have been colored or interacted with in people's classrooms and just seeing it come to life with other people.
We're talking about a new disability justice coloring book. It's called Crip Wisdoms, and it was created by two doctoral candidates at UW-Madison. M. Knott and Miso Kwok are with us in the studio to talk about their collaboration on this project, which blends art and disability justice. Miso, there are image descriptions throughout the book, and usually at this detailed paragraph describing what is shown on the previous page. How important are these image descriptions for you in your everyday life?
Very important is my short answer. So for listeners who are kind of curious why this conversation is coming up, so I'm a blind person and I cannot see any images, but we live in such a world that is very heavily driven by lots of different images, whether you are opening your phone to Instagram or whether you are kind of checking out a map. Some of my blind friends and I will kind of coin this term, like use this term of sighted world. So as a blind person living in the sighted world, I acknowledge and embrace the importance of images. And in fact, having been raised by a mathematics educator, I think I think a lot in images as well, you know, for example, if I'm trying to understand a path from point A to point B, I'm kind of mentally imaging that path. So image is actually a really important part of my life as well. But obviously, kind of access to tactile image is very few and far, unfortunately. So text is a good way for me and many blind folks to understand what image is drawn or what image is being projected. And knowing that M is the visual artist, and it was going to be about a coloring book. And I think it was really important for me to say, I think we should include image descriptions and not just kind of the basic, like something like person is just like lying down on the sand and like moon is on the background. And it's kind of, yeah, like intellectual ideas, but making sure that these ideas are as widely understood as possible. So I think just that work of reviewing and writing image descriptions together was something that I cherish.
And that particular description is so vivid. And like it said, like femme, fat person on beach on their side, and conch shell as large as that. You know, I really love that aspect of it, Em, that these aren't just these aren't basic descriptions. They really paint a picture in your head.
And I think MISO really manifested that and made that true. We did so much work together iteratively because we were coming up with these images together. And so MISO would say, well, it looks like this. And I would say, okay, here's the thumbnail sketch. And she, no, it's this is over here. And what if it has this? So it was very much like this reflexive process of developing images and descriptions together that, and MISO, I love that you used the word cherish. I just smiled really big because I cherished that process too. It was really a beautiful process to engage in.
MISO, you brought about, you brought this tactile version of the book. And I'm wondering, can you tell us more about the features it includes?
Yeah. So kind of going back to the conversation around image, there is a technology educator who's also a blind person that I follow on the internet. Her name is Chansey Fleet. She coined this term image poverty to talk about how blind people are often deprived from exposure to image. And I really liked that term image poverty because I think it aptly captures this experience many blind folks have. And kind of thinking about this coloring book, first of all, like selfishly, I was thinking, okay, if this is a coloring book and if I'm part of this and if I can't color in the book because I don't know where to color, like that would be kind of, I would feel like I'm missing out.
You're missing out on it, yeah.
So that was kind of the selfish reason. But I really think that to engage in this idea of multiple ways of knowing and multiple in identities being represented, I think it was really important for us to think about how to make this book as inclusive and as accessible as possible. And we are so grateful that we were able to connect with Clover Nook Printing House that really ran with this idea of, yeah, let's make these drawings into tactile images. It's really costly, both on the financial end and time-wise, to kind of produce graphics like this, and especially hand-drawn works like what M practices as an artist. So we are really grateful for their collaboration. And I think my hope is that having tactile books available will invite not only blind folks, but everybody to have a chance at engaging with images in a different way and in a more interactive way.
Well, Em and MISO, thank you so much for sharing this project with us.
Thank you so much
for having us.
That was Emily Knott and MISO Kwok. They are graduate students in education programs at UW-Madison, and we've been talking about their new coloring and activity zine called Crip Wisdoms. A Braille and tactile version of the zine is available through the publisher Clover Nook Press. And 100% of MISO and M's profits from the book are going to Disability Visibility Project.
The federal government shutdown has raised some concerns over air travel as air traffic controllers, already short-staffed, face the prospect of working without pay, but there haven't been major delays at this point.
And now the Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy has ordered a 10% cut in flights at dozens of major airports due to the shutdown. And we're wondering,
Is this having an impact on your travel plans in the next week or ahead into the holidays?
Have you been deciding between flying or driving or flying and not traveling at all? And has the shutdown made that decision any more complicated for you? And if you work in any part of the air travel experience, we'd definitely like to hear your thoughts and experiences.
Email us at wisconsintoday@wpr.org, or you can call or text to get in touch. The number is 888-642-0232. Once again, that's 888-642-0232.
Wisconsin Today producers include Rochelle Wilson and Mackenzie Crummy.
Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful.
Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to WPR News.